Well, okay, so I said that, you know, it's a gray, rainy day, and I was sitting around saying, oh, wouldn't it be nice to not to go to church, but I have to. Occupational hazard. But this is a tough topic to talk about sin on a doldrum day such as today, but it's an incredibly, let me say, subversive but interesting text. If we can close the door in the back, that'd be great. Because what we've seen, hopefully what you've seen with sin, this topic, it's a heavy word, it's a big word. And if you're a Christian or if you're not a believer, you have to get your head around sin. And what I hope you've seen over the last few weeks, what I hope that I've been able to communicate through the Bible is that sin, primarily, it's not simply the breaking of rules. There's that element to it, yes. I don't want to look over that. And we'll get to some of the parts of the Bible where they talk about sin as breaking the rules and doing the bad stuff and doing the stuff you know you shouldn't do and doing the stuff that you wouldn't do if everybody around you knew that you were doing it and doing the stuff that you wouldn't do if everybody could get a hold of that information and hold it against you. It's not simply breaking rules. Because with all due respect, that's a very spiritually naive way to look at sin. It's a very superficial and shallow way to look at it. And it also creates what I would call like a logical inerrancy. Look at this. If sin is simply breaking rules, then what you have is a gradation of sin. Do you not? You take one person, I'm pointing over here, no, it could be anybody, who breaks five rules. And you say, well, they're a fairly religious person. They're a good person. You have some person who breaks 20 rules, and they're a little bit worse. And you have somebody who breaks 50 rules, and you say, well, they're a bad seed. And then you have somebody who breaks 100 rules. Do you see? The level of, if you only think that sin is breaking of rules and not the relationship with God, then you'll vastly oversimplify sin. You'll be able to say to yourself, well, I've only broken five rules today. Check the box. I'm good. I'm okay. I'm not that guy who broke 20 or that girl who broke 20 or 50 or 100. But in this passage, what you see is that God is not saying that sin is the breaking of a rule. Rather, he's pointing out sin is where you and I put our roots down. It's where you and I find stability, meaning, find our very life. Look at the passage. Who's he talking to? He's not talking to the dirty sinners out there. He's talking to his people, Judah. He's talking to the Bible believers, the people who had all the answers. They knew the stories. They knew God himself. And yet he says something very heavy in verse 1. He says, your sin, Judah, is written with a pen of iron, with a point of a diamond. And that may not mean much to you and me tonight, but in essence, God is saying this, Judah, don't get it twisted. Judah, understand that you are a complete and utter mess, Judah, my people. These are the people on the inside. These are the religious folks, and they should have all the answers. And yet God says it's written with iron. That's a heavy, heavy, heavy phrase. We might say something like, it's written in stone. You can't take it back. He's looking at his own people, the people who should have their lives together. And yet he's saying, here's why you have anxieties. Here's why you worry, people. Do you see this? When he talks about the shrub, which we'll get into in a second, and the tree, he says one of them doesn't know anxiety. One of them is riddled with it. But before I get in there, let me look at this first. See, he says in verse 9, look, the heart above all things, our heart, is deceitful. We're going to live lives that tell us we're okay. Yeah, we're not perfect, but we're not that bad. And here he comes to Judah and he says, look, in verse 9, he says, your heart, above everything, your heart's going to deceive you. It's very easy, for example, to tell people all the bad things they've done. It's very difficult to tell them all the bad things they are. Let me say that again. I stand up here for about 30 minutes every Sunday, and I can tell you all the bad things you've done or I've done. That's easy. That's guilt. I can guilt you. I can shame you. And I can do it with my kids. It sometimes works with them. It doesn't work so well with adults. But from being a pastor, I can get away with it sometimes. But that's not what he's doing in the passage here. He's not looking at the people and telling them fundamentally all the bad things they've done. He's telling them fundamentally the bad things they are. The heart above everything will deceive, he says. You and I are bound to tell ourselves we're okay. And yet, why do we worry? Why do we stress? Why do we have anxieties? Because we're more like the shrub than the tree. I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. First, let me give a little context here. For those, I said this was a rather obscure passage. If you're not that familiar with the book of Jeremiah or Jeremiah himself, let me give you some context for this because it's important for understanding the passage. Who is Jeremiah? He's a prophet. He's called one of the major prophets, not because he was better than anybody else. It's just because his book is longer than most of the prophets' books. We think that Jeremiah started prophesying when he was a young man. And he probably prophesied for about 40 or 50 years. Now, hold on. When I say that Jeremiah was a prophet, you must know that it isn't the type of prophet that you and I think of these days. When you and I tend to say the word prophet or prophecy, we think of somebody who's telling the future. We think of somebody you go to when you find out what's going to go on in the future. And we say, no, 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 that's not right. Actually, biblically speaking, that's not primarily what a prophet did. A prophet wasn't just the future fortune teller of the people. The prophet was like a big megaphone. He was God's mouthpiece to the people. And because of that, prophets would go to the people of God and tell them all the bad things they were. They'd say, you're the shrub, not the tree. And you know what? If you tell people enough times that they're a shrub and not a tree, they don't like you that much. This is consequently why a lot of these prophets weren't that popular. And Jeremiah was the least of them. He's referred to in some literatures as the man of suffering. He was credited with writing the Book of Lamentations as the prophet who suffered. He's of all the prophets, he's probably the most persecuted. Why? Because he's going to the people and saying, here's your heart. Here's what's really wrong with you. Not just the bad immoral deeds that you do. Those are easy to point out. They're hard to get over sometimes, but they're easy to identify. But he looks at them and he says, here's your heart, Judah. And they don't like it one bit. We know that Jeremiah served under King Josiah for a long time. And he was a good king. But Jeremiah served under some pretty bad kings as well. In that 40 to 50 year time frame that he was being a prophet, and every time he had to go to the people and tell them, this is what's really going on in your life. This is why you're stressed. This is why you're worried. This is why you feel like you're withering and dying. And they didn't like it, and they wanted to get rid of him at times, many times. Because we know that at this point in history, Jeremiah, when he's prophesying, it's a unique point in history. It's when there starts to be called the advent of kingdoms, of empires, of wars. And in the book of Jeremiah, of course, the people are going to be exiled. They're going to be carried off into Babylon. And they're going to have to figure out how to live in a multicultural urban environment. They're going to have to learn how to live out their faith at work. How to live out their faith at school, how to live out their faith in their jobs, in their cubicles, in a big city that's foreign to them. Does this sound familiar to you? It's you. It's me. And Jeremiah is coming to a people who have a fragmented view of reality. They're God's people, yes, but they find themselves in a foreign culture. And even God says this. He says, I'm going to give you over to them. And essentially, you're going to have to learn, you and me and them, the people of Judah, have to learn how to live out their faith. Are you going to be a shrub or are you going to be a tree? That, he says, is the essence of sin. It's not simply doing the bad things. Shame on you. Come up and I'll slap your wrist. No. God says, I don't want to slap your wrist. I want you to see your heart. And the whole message today about being rooted, whether you're a shrub or a tree, whether you're rooted and how your roots are laid down will incredibly determine the path and trajectory of your life. Why do you and I stress out? What worries us? What gives us anxiety when the dry seasons come in our life? When money starts to run out, when our job starts to not look so good, when friends abandon us, when we're lost, alone, and lonely in a new place? It's because we're a shrub. He wants us to be the tree. This is not exactly what we would think of sin. But this is a sin of trust. Jeremiah is speaking to a people who have a hard time trusting in God. Plain and simple. That's what he says here. Go back to your passage. He says, look, cursed is the man who trusts in man. He's like a shrub. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is the Lord. By the way, that's really interesting why he repeats it, and I'll explain why in a minute. He says, blessed is the man whose trust in the Lord and whose trust is the Lord. He's like a tree. The other one's like a shrub. What's he saying? He says at the bottom, you have to see, and I have to see, that sin has to deal with our roots. Where are your roots, and how far do they go down today? Because the length to which they go down into the gospel will be the length to which you will be able to withstand the droughts of your life, the pains of your life, the worries of your life, the uncertainties of your life. A shrub withers and folds. A tree stands. Not because it's any better than the shrub, but because its roots go infinitely deeper into something more powerful, and it's called a fountain of living water. Let me explain. First, this whole business of the shrub and the tree. What did I mean? Look back at your passage, and he gives a direct contrast. He's talking about anxiety, and he's talking about worry, and you say, okay, Pastor, what's the answer then? How do I stop worrying? He says, look at your roots. And he gives these two illustrations, and one of them is called a shrub, and it depends, I don't know, go into your translations. If you have the old King James Version, it might say a heath or something. It calls it some weird word that I don't even know what it is in English. It's a shrub, but what it actually in Hebrew, you know what it means? A naked plant. Naked. It has no leaves. It has no source of sustenance, this shrub. It's not a nice shrub that you say, well, let me go sit by. It's a shrub that cannot give you shade. It can't give you comfort. It can't give you rest and reprieve from the heat. And he even says that this shrub, even when good things come to it, it won't even recognize the good things. It won't even know the good things because it's too busy battling off the heat, which it can't battle off. Why? Because of its roots. The other illustration that he gives is of a tree. A tree planted by streams of water. And it's got shade, and it's got rest, and it's got comfort, and it runs deep. Today, look at these illustrations and ask yourself which one you want to be. The gospel makes you into the tree. Trusting in yourself or anything else in this world will make you into the shrub. When the heat comes, you wither. When the pain, the loss, and the tragedy, and the uncertainty of your life, and you don't know which way to go comes, and it will. The shrub withers, the tree survives. First, look at this. Play this. I'm going to work on this metaphor for you and work it out in this message. Think through this. Implications of a tree and a shrub. What do roots do? And I looked it up. You can look it up too. What do roots in a tree or a plant do? Fundamentally, they do two things. Look. Fundamentally, a root of a plant or a tree do two things. One, they anchor the plant or the tree. They keep it still. Without the roots, the thing goes bye-bye when the wind comes. Secondly, they give nutrients to the tree or the plant. So the roots do fundamentally two things. Look, play this out in your lives then. Practically, what does this mean for you? If you're a shrub or a tree, look, roots anchor and support. Roots give nutrients. And there's a test, and this pastor once gave a test on this, this old British pastor. I won't bore you with his way, but he puts it this way. He says, listen, if you want to know if you're a shrub or a tree, there's a negative test and there's a positive test. Do you want to take a test tonight in a couple of minutes? You can't fail this test, by the way. There's a negative test to determine where your roots are, and there's a positive test. First, the negative. If roots anchor you and me into the ground, into our lives, make us unmovable, immovable, the further down they go, here's the negative test. What worries you? What keeps you up at night? What wakes you up in the morning? What do you stress about? What makes you want to pull your hair out? What is the thing that if it's taken away from you, you will be destroyed? That's what you put your roots in. That's your anchor. That's the thing that's going to hold you steady, and it will hold you steady for a time. But if it's anything other than God, he says, when the heat comes and it takes that thing away, no matter how good it is, a job, a family, love, respect, admiration, reputation, no matter what it is, when the heat comes and withers it and burns it away, you too will be withered because your roots have only gone as far as that goes deep into the ground. Secondly, the negative test says, what do you worry about? What do you and I stress about? That's what we're putting our roots in. The positive test, though, there's a positive test. What nourishes you? Remember, I said roots do two things. They anchor you and they nourish you. And here's the test this pastor said. He said, here's the positive test. Think about, in your solitude, where do you go to find rest? What do you think about when there's nothing to think about? See, on the one end, the negative side is, what stresses you out? What worries me and you? Look at the people of Judah. He says, the shrub will get anxious. The tree never does. But then on the positive side, what gives you and me nutrients? What nourishes us? What do we think about when there's nothing else to think about in our lives? What recharges you? Think about it this way. when you're alone and there's nothing to think about, do you start thinking about money? Do you start thinking about security and comfort? That's where your roots are. When you're alone and there's nothing to think about, do you start thinking about other people and the ways in which you need to help them or what other people might be thinking about you? There's your roots, he would say. He says, blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is the Lord. And it's idiomatic, and you got to learn that when somebody repeats something in the Bible, it's definitely worth paying attention to. What does it mean to say that you can trust in the Lord and have trust that is the Lord? What does that whole thing mean? It sounds really odd. And it sounds, well, kind of like obvious. Well, your trust is in the Lord and your trust is the Lord. No, he's saying, you and I can fully trust in the Lord without our trust being of the Lord. By that I mean this, your roots may be planted in something and you trust God to provide you that thing. You trust in the Lord to provide you a family. You trust in the Lord to provide you happiness. You trust in the Lord to provide you a good job. But see, at the end of the day, your trust is the job. Your trust is the family. Your trust is the thing that's going to give you ultimate happiness, not him. You're trusting God, and we are trusting God in and only as much as he delivers for us. And that's what he means when he says your trust, blessed is the man whose trust is in the Lord and whose trust is the Lord. He's saying you can entirely have one without the other. You and I, with our mouths, Judah does it. All the people of God did it. We see it with Jonah last week, remember? He said, God, I know you're gracious, slow to anger and abounding in love. Perfect doctrinal confession. And yet he doesn't understand a bit about grace. Because Jonah's trust is in the deliverance of God to meet his terms. Judah, the people's trust, is in the ability of God to deliver on their terms. And he says, if your trust is in God to meet your conditions, then that really shows that your roots are in those conditions. And when those conditions or circumstances aren't met, what happens? You wither. The heat comes. But see, the tree, it says, are planted and the roots are deep. You know what this means? It means that when the heat comes, it's not going to feel it. It means that for you and me, when we say what we're rooted in, when we really search our hearts out, what's your roots tonight? Do they only go in as deep as the things you see around you, the things you can count and measure and quantify and hold and touch? Those things will leave you one day. And when they do, your roots will wither. The wind will blow and it'll blow you away. And I know some of you feel like that, that you're being tossed about like wind every once in a while and you don't know which direction to go. He's saying to the people, that's because you're a shrub. And it's not because your roots are in the wrong place, necessarily speaking. Look, the shrub and the plant, the shrub and the tree, they have roots. And he doesn't say the roots are in the wrong place. He's just saying they're so shallow. There's infinite joy for you and me. But we stress and fret and worry. Why? Because we've planted ourselves down in what we see and what we know and what we can feel and what we can quantify. And God says, there's something far deeper, far richer than that. What's the result then? How do you know? I said the negative test is this. Ask yourself, what do you worry about? What do you stress about? That's what's anchoring you down. The positive test is, what nourishes you? What gives you joy, even momentarily? That's what you're getting nourishment from and nutrients from. And those are good nutrients, and they'll last for a while, but they're not going to last for the long run. God says, I have to be the source of nourishment for you. I have to be the thing you plant yourself down in. I have to be, he would say, where you find your value, your identity, your worth. Then and only then, nothing, nothing, nothing will wither you. You can stand any heat if your roots go deep in him. Play this metaphor out again. If you're the bush, what's the result? He says it in this passage. He says the bush, it won't know prosperity. And you probably know these people, the shrubs. And maybe you feel like this in your life, and we're all a bit of a shrub. That even when the good times come, it's never enough. We need more. The good times, he says, they won't even know prosperity when it comes. It'll come upon it, and it's a shrub. And its roots are so shallow and so superficial, and it's pleased by so little that it won't even know the good stuff when it comes. But the tree, it says, will know no drought. The tough times won't be able to touch you, he would say. You and I are going to go through droughts. We do. We have. We all have. And I've heard some of you do this, and I know my own droughts. And there's a way to go through a drought period in your life, a way to go through a dry period. When the heat's bearing down on you and you're suffering and you're saying, I don't know which way to go, I'm withering. You can look at it one of two ways and you can say, well, trouble, well, suffering, I'm rubber, you're glue, whatever you say bounces off me and sticks to you. Good, be defiant, be strong. That'll get you so far. That's not the type of toughness he's talking about. He's not talking about mental fortitude to get through the droughts. He's asking, where are your roots when the droughts come? And if they're in the living water, the one who comes later and calls himself the living water, then you and I will be unshakable. Furthermore, work this metaphor out again. If you and me have roots and we're the tree, not the shrub, you know what that means? We give shade to others. We're a source of comfort for others in the world. A shrub, who wants to sit next to a shrub? It doesn't do anything for you. But you look at that big old tree and you say, I want to sit under that. I want to know how far those roots go down. Is that what people would say about you and me in life? Would they look at us and say, wow, you're just withering about like a shrub? Or would they say, no, you look like a tree and I want to come sit under you and learn and get shade and get loved and listen to this? Judah, at the beginning of this passage, he says, in every aspect of your life, Judah, you've given up on me. He says it in your altars, in your green hills, on your mountainsides, everywhere, Judah. You put your roots into something other than me. Go, good. Because when the heat comes, and it will, you'll wither. Unless you and I can get planted. And what does it mean now? Let me bring it back to the real world here. What does it mean to be planted? I know that sounds nice, doesn't it? Who wants to be a tree? Raise your hand. Who wants to be a shrub? Raise your hand. Go, test. Let's see. Shrub, tree, no. Of course everybody wants to be the tree. Then how do you get there? It comes in this passage, and we didn't read it because we didn't have enough time. But if you look at Jeremiah, look back at what he says here. At the end of the passage, you would think that he ends by saying this. He says, O Lord, the hope of Israel, all who forsake you, shall be put to shame. Those who turn away from you shall be written in the earth, for they have forsaken the Lord, the fountain of living water. And then one of the next lines he says is, Lord, heal me. Pause. Jeremiah doesn't say, I want to be a tree. Gosh darn it. Jeremiah doesn't say, I want to be a tree. I got to pray more. He doesn't say, I want to be a tree, so I'm going to just try it out and tough it out. He goes to God and he says, Jeremiah, the people, he says, you have to go and say, heal me. A tree. How do you get to be a shrub in the desert versus a tree by the water? You can't replant yourself if you're a tree. I don't know if you've ever seen trees. They don't plant themselves. Something needs to come from the outside and replant them. How do you and I move from being a shrub that gets withered to being the tree by the water? You can't do it on your own. Jeremiah knows it. He doesn't say, I'll just try harder and I'll be the tree. He doesn't just say, I'll work harder, I'll be the tree. He doesn't say, I'll pray harder, read my Bible more, and I'll be the tree. No. He knows he needs to be replanted. He knows he needs to be reborn, just like you and me. Look at verse 13. God says that God is the fountain of the living water. And there's somebody much later who comes, and you remember, this person sits by a woman at the well, and he says, I have water, that when you drink it, you'll never need any more water. Jesus says, I'm the water you need. Replant yourself with me. And the parallels don't stop there. Jeremiah, I gave you as an example before, was called the prophet. He was called the suffering prophet, the prophet who cried because he was responsible for Lamentations. He was always crying for the people. He was always lamenting for them. He knew their heart, and he knew they were just little shrubs, and he wants them to be trees. There's one who comes later who gets compared to Jeremiah. In Matthew 16, the apostles and everybody looks around and says, who's this guy? Is he like Jeremiah? No, he's one greater than him. Jeremiah was a man of sufferings who pointed out the heart of people. Jesus was a man of sufferings who died for the heart of you and me. There was one person, Jesus, who in heaven, by the way, He drank that living water all the time. He was what you would call cosmically hydrated. He never thirsted. He always had the sweetness of water, the living water, the fountain of God. He was in perfect relationship with him. Yet when he goes to the cross, what does he say in the book of John? I thirst. As a way to say that you and me, when we feel the heat come down in our lives, and we would look to God and say a lot of bad things, but mainly we would say, God, I'm thirsty. I'm parched. I'm dried out. I'm withered. Do you know that that heat that comes on you is infinitely less than the heat that came on him on the cross? He's the one, Jesus, who gets, he was the tree by the water. He gets tossed out in the wasteland as a shrub outside the city, dying and saying, I thirst. That's what makes you and me know we can be trees. We don't have to put our roots down in anything that could be wiped away when the heat comes. You don't put your roots down in your job, because when the heat comes and you lose it, you'll lose your roots. You don't put your roots down even in your family, because you know sometime, some way, you'll lose them maybe. And some of you may have lost your family in some way. If your roots are in there, you'll be with it. You will wither and die. And Jesus says, put your roots in me. I'm the one. I'm the one who was by that water, and I came and I thirsted, so that you know when you thirst, you never will die from it the way I did, Jesus would say. He got tossed to the wasteland so that you and I get into the heaven place. We get to drink that water. Don't you want that? He says, listen, you want the answer to anxiety and worry and stress in your life. They're coming. And when it comes, where your roots will be, will they be in something that can be shaken, or will they be in him who can never be shaken? The one who said, I thirst for you, my roots are withered and dried. I'm tossed to the wasteland. And T.S. Eliot in his poem, The Wasteland, it's a rather obscure poem. You can read it. It's a long one. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you, but he captures this better, much better than I can. So let a poem do what I cannot do today. He says this in The Wasteland, and he says, what are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish, son of man? He's saying, look at your life. Where are your roots? What branches are you growing? He continues saying, you cannot say or guess, for you only know a heap of broken images where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief. He says, you and me in our life are going to go through dry seasons when the sun beats us down and there will be no relief. There will be no dead tree. There will be no shade for us. You'll feel that heat beat down on your shoulders and on your head, and you'll hate your life at the time. And he says, in the dry stone, no sound of water, only, there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow at the morning striding behind you, or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. What is he saying? I'll translate it. Here's your crib notes. You know what he says when he says your shadow at the morning striding behind you? That means the things that follow you when you wake up in the morning that worry you. And he says, or your shadow at evening rising to meet you? That means when you go to sleep at night, all the things you stress about and worry about, that you have anxiety about the next day. He says, come here under this red rock, a rock that bleeds. And there you'll find the shade that you need. No shadow of the morning to chase you. No shadow of the evening to scare you. Under the red rock, and what is that red rock? It is the rock who bleeds. It's Jesus himself. He bleeds, and he says, only under me will you find shade. How does that work out practically? I don't know. I wish I could go into it. We don't have the time. You work it out. What does it mean to go under the rock for the shade, rather than try to make your own shade? It means that under the red rock, you and me find the shade we've always craved, the water that we've always thirsted for. And as Eliot writes, no shadow will chase us and no shadow will lead us. We don't get the shadow at morning and the worry of the day. We don't get the shadow at evening, the fear of the future. We get the bleeding rock. We get him who says, I thirst. Let me tell you a story real quick as I close. Story about Phoebe and Fanny. They're real people. I know, it sounds weird. Phoebe Knapp and Fanny Crosby. And they were friends. Two women in the 1800s. And they were very different friends. They were kind of called an odd couple. They were very both Christian people. Fanny was blind. Fanny was starting to be known very famously as a hymn writer in the day. Fanny Crosby was responsible for writing a bunch of hymns. And she paired up, and she paired up with Phoebe Knapp, who was a pillar in the church. And Phoebe Knapp came from a family. Her mother's name was Phoebe, by the way, Phoebe Palmer. And Phoebe Palmer and her husband were these religious stalwarts in the church at the time. And they were responsible for creating something we call the holiness movement at the time. These were really good Christians, and Phoebe Knapp was raised in a good Christian household. And she was a good Christian. She went to church all the time. And she'd play music for Fanny. Fanny would write the words, and Phoebe would write the music. And there was a time that Fanny would invite Phoebe over to her house. Fanny had a big old house, a big old mansion, and Fanny Crosby was a little more humble. She tended to give her money away. She had just like a little apartment. But inside of Phoebe's house were all these wonderful, beautiful musical instruments. And so when they comprised most of their hymns and when they worked together, they were good friends. Fanny would come over, and Fanny would pen the words, and Phoebe would write the music. And there's one time that Fanny came over, and Phoebe wrote a song. And she said, "Here's the tune, but I don't know the words to this." She says, "I have the music. I have the tune in my head. Here it is." She starts playing it. And all of a sudden, Fanny goes down on her knees in prayer. And she prays for a little bit. And at the end of the song, at the end of the tune, when Phoebe's just finishing up, Fanny shoots up. And you know what Fanny says? She says, "That song, I know what it is now. It's Blessed Assurance. Jesus is mine." And it says sometime later that Phoebe was actually quite rocked by that. And this is why. Because for Phoebe, growing up as a child, her mother Phoebe was plagued by doubts in her faith. She was plagued by the need to know that God really did love her. And at the time, all the people at the church were telling her, "You need some miraculous experience in order to know that Jesus loves you. You need some clouds to part from the sky in order to know." And they wanted this big religious experience. And Phoebe's mother was riddled with this. And she said, "I don't understand. I don't have this assurance. How do I do it?" And when Phoebe, her daughter, and her friend Fanny says, "I know that tune. Blessed Assurance, Jesus is mine. Oh, what a foretaste of glory divine, heir of salvation, purchase of God, born of his spirit, washed in his blood." And Phoebe at the time knew she didn't need those clouds to part. She knew the assurance just by singing the words to that old hymn. Can you sing that tonight? Where's your assurance starting tomorrow morning? "Blessed Assurance, Jesus is mine. Oh, what a foretaste of glory divine." You know what foretaste is? It's that water that you and I so desperately need. And it comes, the shade comes, the water comes, the refreshment comes under the red rock. Go to him on the cross. He's the one who thirsted. Why? For you. So when the heat comes on you, you know it's nothing like the heat that rained on him. And you can sing as we're about to. "Blessed Assurance, Jesus is mine. Oh, what a foretaste of glory divine." Go in prayer now. Consider this.